the design selection of the insulation techniques for the liquid hydrogen tank has been told quite a few times. It's been outlined in my paper, but the essence of this was to find an insulation device that would limit the boil off of the liquid hydrogen to the point that it would make the mission possible. Now, boil off is important in several instances. Prior to liftoff, we've got to make sure that we have sufficient hydrogen aboard to make the mission. And on the pad, we have varying weather conditions, either hot sun, driving rain, or things of that nature, which have a powerful influence on the boil-off characteristics of the liquid hydrogen. So firstly, you want to be able to control that boil-off so that the replenishing capability is reasonable. Next, you want to make sure that once you have gone into orbit, the in-orbit boil-off that occurs between the first engine shutdown and the second start for translunar injection is a reasonable amount of boil-off so that you don't lose more hydrogen than is necessary. And,
do you have a big boil-off rate in orbit up there?
Oh, yes. It's let's be careful of the word big.
Okay.
We have controlled the boil-off rate to the point where it is quite acceptable, but at one time we were concerned.
But you still have a boil-off rate, I guess.
Yes,
that's what I meant.
That's right. The solar radiation coming to the tank and transmitting itself through the tank into the hydrogen and heating it up is significant. That's why we have to be very careful on the type of paint that we have on the exterior of the tank, so the emissivity characteristics are proper and are such that they don't create a boil-off problem. That's why we go to white paint and why we check the characteristics of emissivity prior to liftoff, and why we put special insulation devices at the forward dome and the like.
Now, excuse me, that is a new parameter that I hadn't thought of or haven't come across before, really, is the paint on the exterior. Now, did this require a new kind of formula, or were you able to reach in the barrel and come up with something?
Well, essentially, it wasn't much different than reaching in the barrel and picking the paint with the right emissivity.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, do the Russians use paint?
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
They have the same sort of problems.
Same things, yeah. Yeah. Okay, excuse me, go ahead with the insulation here then, yeah.
Well, the key decision that was made on the S4 and the S4B was whether to put the insulation inside the tank or put it outside of the tank.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, the S2 insulation is outside of the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And there are advantages to both methods, and both methods have their disadvantages. They both have problems. The approach that we took was an internal insulation. We felt that, at least in our minds, that doing a good job of insulating the tank internally was the right approach. We were primarily concerned with handling problems after the job was finished. This permitted us to do the job and finish it, inspect it, and for all practical purposes be done with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we talked to the North American people and looked at their equipment for external insulation. Was, again, your decision to go the internal route partly because of the kind of a state-of-the-art thing. Yours was ahead of the S2.
Well, I think you might say we took a more conservative approach at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think today you could look at either one of the techniques and the decision could be made to go either internal or external, and a very adequate job of insulation could be done with either process.
Mm-hmm.
I think it boils down now to the economics of the two methods of insulation. Both of them are quite satisfactory. The S2 does a very credible job with their external insulation. I would imagine that the next time the problem presents itself, there will be a considerable number of trade-off studies to determine whether we would go internal or external insulation, and mm-hmm. I don't know what the answer would be right now.
Mm-hmm.
Either technique will do the job.
Well, now, on laying these tiles down, I'm fairly familiar, I think, with the construction using the fiberglass and the matrix approach, mm-hmm. the X, Y, and Z axis, and so on. And after you got these things out of the curing molds, they had to be cut to these configurations, and you got a compound curvature up here,
right.
Didn't you, up here on the ends of the tank?
Well,
around the dome area?
Yes, around the dome area.
Okay, now did a technician stand at a grinder and by guess and by golly,
no,
or did you have a taped thing again?
These,
how did you do that?
These are all done as essentially tiles, much like the way you lay linoleum. They just fit in here. This is a very straightforward and easy process.
Mm-hmm.
On the dome being spherical in contour, it's an easy thing to set that up.
Yeah, I beg your pardon. I remember we talked to Ted Smith about that, and he pointed out that this was a perfect sphere, really, and so the no real problem with curves. It's a straightforward mathematical situation.
Mm-hmm.
But each one of these was numbered, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you came in on this little conveyor belt
mm-hmm.
up here, and
here they are coming. Yes,
was laid in, yeah. Are these special shoes, or they just look like?
No, those are special shoes.
Yeah. And it was this stuff is resilient enough. You didn't get too much depression, or that didn't make
strong.
Any difference. Yeah.
It's really quite strong.
You were trying to find balsa wood at one time for that, weren't
well,
you?
Well, as a matter of fact, the original design concept called for balsa. Balsa wood is an excellent insulator, and if we could have gotten enough balsa wood with proper quality of the balsa, we probably would have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out that it was cheaper to invent our own balsa wood, which is what we did because of the quality control problems.
Uh-huh.
So now we were assured of the characteristics of the insulating material, and the repeatability was much more precise and predictable.
Yeah. One of the things that we'll be dealing with in this history, although to a lesser extent than other aspects, is a spin-off. And I was wondering if this particular kind of insulation has, to your knowledge, any particular commercial application.
Oh yes, lining of tankers that transmit methane gasoline or gas.
Methane gas, uh-huh. In liquid state.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You say tankers? Are these road tankers, or are you talking
these
about ships?
These are ships.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There are some people thinking in terms of using this as the insulation device on a pure economics basis.
Mm-hmm.
In competition with other insulation devices such as plywood, cardboard type of things, or vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have some more pictures there you want to go through, or is this? Say, excuse me, again, there's one thing I wanted to ask. Logistics for the S4 and S4B use the guppy and the super guppy.
Mm-hmm.
And
the barge.
In the barge, yeah. Someone told me the super guppy crashed. a few months ago. He thought it had. Did you hear anything about that?
There was a crash of a Super Guppy, yes. And several people were killed.
Huh.
It occurred up at Edwards. I think they were doing some one engine out type of qualifying maneuvers, and somehow or other they lost control of the airplane and went in.
Hmm.
I'm not any more familiar with it than that.
But as far as the space program, or at least the S-4B, this is not a critical factor anymore because the stages have been delivered.
Well, any deliveries we would make now would make by barge anyway.
Is barge cheaper than flying them?
Well, I'm not sure it's any cheaper. Maybe. At least we got plenty of time.
Yeah, at this point, yeah.
I have a series of charts here which sort of go over the milestones.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Things of this nature that may be of interest to you.
Mm-hmm.
This being the beginning of the contract in April of 1962, our first S-4B launch, which was off of a 1B configuration 201 in February 26, 1966. And of course the big one here was the first Apollo configuration, Saturn V, vehicle 501 in November the 9th, 1967. And Wally Schirra's flight on launch vehicle 205 in October the 11th, 1968, and first manned launch on 503, December 21st, 1968. That was Frank Borman's mission.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the first moon landing with Armstrong in July 16th of
1969. Mm-hmm. Again, one of the things that has struck us in writing this is that we come up with a chart like this. Here are the launches, and everybody apparently was at least satisfied. Can you tell us how you felt about launches? I mean, great release, or there's just no emotion in the reports. And we, you know, surely people reacted to these one way or another. How did you react? What went on?
Well, let me tell you from the experience that I have had, where we had been flying quite a few vehicles that were unmanned in nature, it was quite quite a change. We had had flight failures on Thor. The early days on Thor were very disappointing until about the fourth or fifth launch, and then everything sort of fitted together properly, and the launch program went on quite well, as a matter of fact, extraordinarily well. But we had come from a development environment which had had flight failures in the early parts of program, so we were always very, very sensitive to the possibilities of in-flight failures. Now, when you get to something like the Saturn V or even the Saturn 1B, an in-flight failure is a very undesirable thing. I think it's to the great credit of this particular program and the way this part of the problem was attacked and successfully solved that the number of in-flight failures has been, for all practical purposes, zero. We've had anomalies, and I think it is fair to say that we've been limited to anomalies in our flight program. Maybe 502 with the premature engine shutdowns that were associated with that mission can be called in-flight failures, but they were pretty passive as when you compare them to the in-flight failures that Thor and Atlas and Titan and other programs have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, every launch was a very, very highly charged emotional experience. And in our case, it wasn't a matter of just getting off the pad. We had to get off the pad and get a ride up to altitude and start, shut down, and wait for about an hour or so, and then start up again.
Yeah.
And it was always the second start that I think had more excitement to it than anything else.
Yeah.
As we had had just more time for something to go wrong, but we've had a very wonderful history of excellent restarts. Mm-hmm. The machine does work very well.
Mm-hmm.
But you are right, it is a very highly emotionally charged experience at a launch or an engine restart.
Okay, I'm not asking what you did afterwards, but what does an engineer do after a successful launch? Does he go out and get quietly blotto, run up and down the beach?
Well, most of us are pretty tired.
Mm-hmm.
Countdowns are fairly long these days. So probably have been awake for 20, 30, maybe 20 hours, I would say, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had any difficulties ahead of the beginning of the countdown and have been involved with any last-minute changes or corrections or things of that nature, it adds to the problem. But of late, the countdowns are very much to the book. We don't get into long holes, things of that nature, as we did in the beginning of the program. But even with that, you're probably on station for anywhere from 8 to 15 hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's over with, you're pretty tired.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take much under those conditions to put you to sleep.
Yeah.
So it's not too good an idea to get too much celebration, because you're liable to find yourself asleep in the corner. But there is a great feeling of exhilaration and a great feeling of accomplishment after these missions. They are truly magnificent technical achievements.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a feeling of great pride to have been part of the team that can put together such a complicated machine as this and watch it perform in a, for all practical purposes, a flawless history
mm-hmm.
of accomplishment. It's truly remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm always, my major feelings after a mission are one of being thankful that nothing has happened and tremendously impressed that that nothing happened of an untoward nature. It's just most remarkable when you think in terms of the many, many opportunities for small devices to malfunction or fail to function or something like that, and yet to find that with the millions and millions of components and literally millions of components that are performing just as expected. It's truly remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
From a purely statistical point of view, it's rather awesome
mm-hmm.
to think how well it is working, which shows that it can be done.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the team. Could you say you are including NASA people, or is this just your...
The entire team.
Yeah.
The team is... in my mind, is a chain which is only as strong as the links.
Yeah.
And this shows up so well during a countdown when you watch the various parties. These are small communities of people who have specific tasks to do, how smoothly they get those jobs done, and the apparent ease of the conduct of the countdown, yet when you realize the tremendous things that are going on, the tremendously complicated activities that are going on all around. And the team literally does not miss a beat.
Mm-hmm.
Its precision is very ordered. The number of times that somebody gets into trouble are small in number now, and their ability to cope with their problems in real-time decision-making is truly remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
They are very expertise in their business. As a combined group of sub-communities, if you will, I think it's truly one of the greatest achievements to be able to pull all of these people together and operate in such a smooth fashion as we see in the Saturn launch.
Yeah, excuse me. Well, I was wondering, in the construction process, how you got along with NASA people. Was everything sweetness and light? Can you remember an occasion when you really had a drag-out fight?
Oh, there have been plenty of stimulating discussions.
I beg your pardon, stimulating discussions.
And I think that's part of the secret of the success of the program, that we not only could, but in fact did, challenge each other technically, management-wise. Nothing was not a subject for sincere, honest discussions and sincere, honest differences of opinion.
Can you think of one example where you really had a sincere discussion about a particular problem that would could use kind of the case history thing? Or?
Well, there were quite a number. I'm just trying to recall one that might be of suitable interest here. We always seem to have differences of opinion on thermodynamic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
That was always quite common. The positions that were taken were one of conservatism on the part of the NASA community, and I might say quite rightfully so. Quite often we would take a position of conservatism within the framework of the mission and the mission mode that we were going to be involved in. And both parties, I think, had good points to their arguments.
Mm-hmm.
The ultra-conservatism that usually won out, and I would say rightfully so, again attributed to the success history.
Mm-hmm.
So while I think both parties had very valid points to any arguments they may take up, I think it was an extremely healthy situation that, in general, the ultra-conservative approach prevailed. And I do not regret that that was the environment.
Yeah.
There were plenty of times when I felt that at a specific instance of consideration, conservatism was being carried perhaps further than necessary for the specific issue involved, but it never bothered me to lose those arguments.
Okay, good. What about Von Braun? And did you have a great deal of personal, you know, contact with him? What kind of a man was he?
The number of contacts that I've had with Dr. Von Braun have not been large in number. Certainly, in the course of the activities, we had quite a few meetings together. I was tremendously impressed with the man, both as an engineer and scientist, but as a leader of people. I was tremendously impressed with his capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that he was one of the truly great leaders of the program, and his guidance was always one of the very strong points in the development of the program. In short, I was tremendously impressed with him.
He made inspection tours, apparently about every 6 months or on something on that order. Were these useful to you? Was it kind of a PR thing, or how?
No, they were extremely useful in a very functional sense, because it gave us an opportunity to assess ourselves and be assessed by others.
Mm-hmm.
The mere process of determining where we were in a fashion that we could clearly state our position to Dr. von Braun and his teammates was very helpful in settling things in our own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And these were always carried out in a manner of a great frankness and open discussion, so that when we weren't quite as far along as we would like to be, we declared it. There was never any reason for holding back on any of our problems. Most of the time, we were in pretty good shape. I'm happy to relate.
<Yeah. laughs>
We were really not in very dire straits very often.
Were there people besides von Braun that impressed you in kind of the same way? Was it strictly a von Braun show, or were there other people, too, that really came through and were very helpful?
We had a great team. Dr. Eberhard Ries is an extremely capable individual. I'm most impressed with Dr. Ries. Dr. Lucas,
mm-hmm.
Carl Heimberg, and, there are just so many of them. One man that I enjoyed working with a great deal was Dr. Rudolph.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We seem to enjoy a great personal relationship. He was one of the hardest working men I have run into in some time.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very, very large job as manager of the Saturn V launch vehicle. And I felt very happy to work with Art.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did a great job. It was a tremendously difficult job for a man of his age.
Did you feel in the Saturn program that you just kept working with the German people? Did it seem to you that some of the American engineers did not rise to administrative levels because the Germans held all the positions?
Oh, no, that never was the case in my mind.
Uh-huh.
There are so many of the, if you will, the non-German community that emerged in positions of great responsibility that I think that is not an applicable situation.
Well, this is one of the things, you know, that you read in some of the Saturn histories and et cetera, was that the Germans kept a very tight rein on things. And of course, it seems to me that's kind of the obvious thing. They came out of the original program.
And that, I guess you could take it from that point, but you must consider that the number of people was very small.
Mm-hmm.
If my memory is correct, we can say that the total number of original Dr. von Braun's German community was about 150, give or take. When you realize that the number of engineers on the program was in excess of 6,000, that's a small percentage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even with the community at Marshall, I think the percentage of or the mix of the original German team and American engineers was quite proper.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was done quite well.
Yeah.
They were good people. They certainly knew what they were doing and had earned their reputation.
Okay, good. Let me